This is a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast, 20 Minutes with Philippa Ballantyne.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robertson.
And you're listening to the Round Table Podcast and this week's 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is the rare opportunity that Brian and I have to sit down with our wonderful guest hosts and actually pick their brains a little bit and delve into their particular process, the way they approach their craft. And this particular episode, I am almost speechless, which is, I know, unfathomable. But honestly, our special guest for this episode of 20 Minutes With has been a part of podcasting for many years and has helped define and shaped the nature of the whole medium, in my humble opinion. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Philippa Ballantyne. Yay! Hey. Thunderous applause! Oh.
I shouldn't cheer for myself. Oh. Right there, I thought you were going to say T. Morris, and I was like, hey!
No. Hopefully that'll be a different episode. But no, today it's all you, Pip, all you. So let me before we actually get into this, let me just run down this this remarkable list of credentials and achievements.
Please do.
Please do or don't. Please don't, oh God.
I'm not ashamed. Go for it.
Good, because it's astonishing. First of all, and this is when I first encountered Pip's work, is Chasing the Bard and the sequel, Digital Magic, both released as Paudio Books. There was also the Books of the Order, Geist and Spectre. There's a new series coming out, the Shifted World series, which is coming out, I think, in June of 2012. Is that correct?
Yes.
And also, of course, the project you're doing with good master T. Morris, the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences, Phoenix Rising, and the Janus Affair, the two novels from that, plus countless short stories and podcast fiction along those lines. Plus, I also discovered that you did some nonfiction work, that you did some content development for New Zealand History on Suite 101.
Yeah, I did my dim, dark past. I actually started off, my very first thing that I ever sold was actually a short story about a bit of Wellington history that somebody dug up.
Ah.
And I earned my first $100.
Sweet! Do you still have that $100? Is that framed up on the wall somewhere?
No.
Spent that sucker quick.
I bought something with it, though. I bought myself a really nice picture and I hung it on the wall, so that would be, you know, it wouldn't just get absorbed into drinking money or anything.
That's awesome.
Just as good.
Absolutely, just as good. And so you can look it on the wall and say, I paid for that with my money.
Yeah.
So let's get into this. Let's start talking about craft and Pip, specifically your craft. And I want to start off with a question. My first exposure to you was doing the voice. Oh God, I forget the character in J. Daniel Sawyer's Down from 10.
Oh, Carol.
Yes, marvelous. Yes. Which was really the all-star cast of all podcasting at the time, and led me to explore T's Chronicles of Rafe and Ascanna, the Moravi Chronicles, and led me to Chasing the Bard. And then Digital Magic, and then the other works that you've done. And I've noticed, and I wanted to ask you, your work seems to evolve very organically from mythology, from either mythology or cultural mythology, in the case of Shakespeare and the numerous rumors and possibilities about his life and existence. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you how, when you are approaching a myth and you are looking at mythology and preparing to transform that into a piece of literature, whether it's a short story or a novel or the foundation for a series, can you deconstruct that process of how you evaluate that and then work that process through to literature?
Well, I think for me, I've always been a myth fanatic. I remember as a kid reading all about Greek mythology and just eating that sort of stuff up. But for me, it's always about characters and the stresses and the horrible things that happen to them, and how when things happen to people, you can really look deep into their character. And I think that's probably the purpose of mythology, is to sort of examine, you know, what it is to be human and what it is to be challenged and stuff like that. So when I do mythology, like when I did Will Shakespeare, and I read lots and stuff about him, what little there is, and
right.
about what sort of person he was, and he seemed to be a good guy, which is kind of different to, you know, many people write male characters and they're, you know, the brooding Heathcliff types. Whereas William Shakespeare seemed to be a genuinely nice guy, according to his friends. So it was interesting to put him in a position where, you know, crazy things would happen to this sort of, not average guy, but nice person, you know? Yeah.
Right, right.
And to see where, and it's also kind of an exploration of where inspiration comes from and maybe magic and something. I mean, I think as writers, you're always trying to understand where creativity and inspiration comes from.
Absolutely.
And one of the answers is, of course, from the fairies, which is about as good an answer as any.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so, yeah, I always look for the characters. I always want to know what's going on in their heads, even when they're in the craziest situations imaginable.
When you work with mythologies, and I have some experiences with this too, as does Brian, the motivations and the story arc of a myth, even the myth of Shakespeare, rarely follows a justifiable arc. Motivations tend to get skewed or just taken for granted. They start doing things because they have to, because that's what the myth tells them to do. Do you find yourself having to fill in the blanks and fabricating those motivations to lash them more tightly to your story arc? And if so, how do you evaluate which motivations are appropriate for the myth you're telling?
Well, I think in Shakespeare's, I mean, he had an incredible drive to do things and write so many plays in such a short amount of time. And I guess in Chasing the Bard, his motivation is he just wants to be with this woman that he's in love with, which is something that everybody can relate to, mostly.
Certainly.
Whether you actually get them in the end or not.
Whether it's a comedy or a tragedy.
Yeah, and that sort of makes it more understandable to the reader rather than just sort of being, you know, this. The thing with Shakespeare is that people elevate him and put him up on a pedestal and he's like, oh, William Shakespeare. And I am pretty sure he didn't live on a pedestal. And so I kind of wanted to get in touch with, you know, what an actual person like him might have been like.
Sure. And with the Geist, with the books of the Order, drawing so heavily on a lot of the ghost mythology and not necessarily undead, but ghost mythology, and then inventing a magic system around that. What was it about that aspect of all the myths to explore, the spirits of the dead and having them work? How did you weave that into the Geist mythology or into the Order mythology?
Well, I think with the undead, the ghostly spirits, I mean, you just have to look on television and there's, you know, there's ghost hunters and there's, you know, spirit labs and all these sort of different things. People actually, it's a hobby to go and find out about places haunted, and it has a pretty deep impact on people, you know, what does happen after we die, and some part of us really wants to believe in ghosts, even if we're terrified of them. So I wanted to take that and say, well, what happens if they aren't, you know, what happens if the base isn't based on the fact that this is the afterlife? What happens if there's actually a sort of an intelligence connected with them? And it was fun that I got to draw on different sort of world mythologies to talk about ghosts. But there's always the central core is that we're terrified of them, but we want them to, we really are invested in wanting them to exist.
Sure, sure.
You mentioned that you seem to be very character driven and that you like to start with character first.
Mm-hmm.
When you are looking at the characters and you're playing with their internal conflict, how does that inform external conflict? How does that drive forward? You start with the character, you start with what their personal struggles are. Mm-hmm. And then do you from there expand out and that kind of brings in what happens to them? Or do you have an idea of what you want them to do outside of just what their internal conflict is?
Well, I mean, for example, I'll take Geist and Saoirse. And with her, I was examining, she's not very nice in the first book.
No.
She's very arrogant. I mean, you see that in a lot of books. People are like, well, there's this wonderful character and they've got all this mighty power. And they're still nice people. When in fact, power like that, I mean, we see that in the real world, does have an effect on your personality. And if you can, you know, summon fire to your hands and, you know, blast them around, and you've been doing that since you were a child, you know, you get a little inflated opinion of yourself.
Sure.
Right. And so when I was working out the plot with Saoirse, it was like, okay, so she's going to take some hits. And then I had to come up with hits that are that are really going to hurt her.
So it was a conscious effort to start her off arrogant and tear her down.
Yeah, yeah. By the end of the series, she's going to have some serious reconsidering to have done. But yeah, and it was fun. And when I read people's reviews and they're like, you know, I really didn't like Saoirse, I was like, yes.
Score.
So well, she has some redeeming features. I don't want to make her totally, you know, despicable.
Well, but, she's the protagonist.
Yeah, she's the protagonist. But that doesn't mean she makes good decisions all the time, or nice decisions. You know, we all like to think we're the hero of our story, but often we hurt people and we stumble around and make mistakes.
Right.
So I kind of want characters to have that as well.
Yeah, and that's what makes them so deep.
Mm.
Absolutely. And authentic.
Yeah, absolutely, and honest. So when you have something like that is such a massive shift that you want to accomplish from point A to point B, what keeps you from one of the issues that I see a lot is sometimes it happens too quickly, or sometimes it doesn't happen fast enough, and it seems to just kind of, you're like, okay, just get to it. How do you balance that in your
way? It's tricky. I mean, it's in Geist. Saoirse has a little bit of the stuffing knocked out of her, but she does at the end of it, she's essentially pretty much the same. I mean, I think she's had little moments of clarity along the way, but then gone back to her. I mean, we do that. We go back to what we know. We go back to old habits. We go back to the ruts that we've already made for ourselves. So I've been lucky with the books of the order that I've got four books to, just count them. Yeah, four to bring, to just kind of draw out her. Denouement, that one.
or as my students say, denouement.
Denouement. I think it depends on what format you're working within. You know, if you're in the novel format, you've got a lot more time to kind of spin things out. Short stories, you can, I couldn't do Saoirse in a short story unless it was about a fight or something like that.
She plays to her strengths.
Yes.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Pip Ballantyne after this promotional break.
They fought in his wars. They were the best of his army. But now, Alexander the Great has exiled the last of his scouts to wander the Indus Valley and find their fate. Fighting disease, strange animals, and a hostile climate, the four remaining scouts encounter something as deadly as it is beautiful. Interlopers, the third volume of author Paul Ellard Cooley's Garaga's Children series. Ebook on sale March 15th, 2012. For more information, please visit shadowpublications.com.
We don't believe and happy endings.
And now let's get back to the conversation with Pip Ballantyne.
So how much? Just out of let's start with Geist. Let's work with Geist. How many drafts did you go through before you reached the final form of Geist?
Oh my goodness.
Roughly ballpark.
Yeah, five or six. I would say quite a few more than sort of average for me.
What was the difference between the first draft and the final draft? What did you discover about the story, the characters, the process between those four or five drafts?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I first started out, it was more Saoirse's story. And by the time I got to the final draft, it was more equally spread between her, Merrick, and Raid. And that, I think it deepened the story quite a bit. I like to write in close third person so that you stick to Saoirse's head, and that limits how things are perceived because she's got her own biases and stuff. So by bringing in the other characters a little bit more, then the whole world is a bit more better explained, I think. Mm. And yeah, I'm just trying to think. I mean, I had my agent and a Gabrielle Harbawi, who works with Dragon Moon, and now I'm working again with Empire. They both ran over the story before I ended up getting sold with Ace, and then I had another editor come on, so it's almost hard for me to remember what the first
many
one
minds.
Was like. Yes, yes, many minds have been in this project.
So the transition from primarily Sorsha's story to the more balanced story involving the other characters, what motivated you to make that shift? What did you discover about the story as it was that made you feel that it needed some balancing?
I think I fell in love. I always come back to the characters, and I think I just fell in love with Raid, but also more surprisingly with Merrick, who is supposed to be the sensitive. He was just created to be the foil for Sorsha. And then as I was writing and editing, I suddenly realized that he had a story and he was interesting, and I wanted to find out how he saw things and how he saw Sorsha. And by seeing Sorsha through his eyes, you get a little bit more of a balanced approach to how things actually are. Because if you look through Sorsha's eyes all the time, I don't know, the world probably looks red.
Red and very, very black and white.
Red, black, and white. Yeah.
Did you find your draft then growing by leaps and bounds in terms of word count? Did it expand, or did you have to kind of cut as you went to expand on those other characters?
I think it's around 100,000 words I usually try and aim for a book. So I don't think it really, I chopped other bits out or rewrote scenes. I went back and rewrote some scenes from Merrick's point of view or Raid's point of view. And took it away from Sorsha. Ha ha.
Main air, Sorsha.
So yeah, I 100,000 is a good word count for me. I mean, with the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences, because I'm writing with T, it's 120 usually.
So you've pretty much been a genre author your whole career, yes?
Yeah, I was actually putting some stuff up on Nook and Kindle the other day, and I actually have one. I was looking through my collection of short stories and stuff you pick up along the way, and I have written one literary short story. One. My entire life.
And Dan Sawyer would praise you for that.
He would, probably.
He would say, good for you.
It's probably full of angst.
Yeah, there you go.
And spirit.
And a wavering storyline, all of that.
Yes, yes.
But excellent character development.
That's right.
Actually, it's a little ode to my family, and it's quite melancholy. And I was like, T was like, you sure you want to put that out there? I was like, yep.
Yep. I'm missing home, and everyone's going to share in my grief.
Well, I mean, I think writers expose themselves, well, literarily speaking, all the time anyway. So, you know.
Do you recommend that as a writer's axiom?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, there's a sort of a fine line where you don't want to put everything in there. I mean, when I wrote Weather Child, which is so far only podcast, it was a story set in New Zealand, and the characters were all based on my family pretty much, but some of them were like composites of different people. And I found that a really good touchstone for, you know, when I was thinking about, okay, what is Ruth going to say now? Actually, in my head, that was my aunt, which is Ruth. Faith is actually in the character. What's she going to say now? And I would think about that person and think, well, what would they say in this situation? So it's a kind of a nice little shortcut way of understanding the characters. And I think, you know, I remember when I was 13, come with me back to when I was 13. And I remember people saying, you know, write what you know. And I was like, but I don't want to write science fiction and fantasy. How can I possibly write what I know? I don't know dragons. I know hobbits, obviously, because I live with, you know, in New Zealand with hobbits, but I can't write.
Oh, now that's a myth. That is totally a myth.
Dave, don't destroy their dreams.
I'm sorry.
We all ride unicorns to work.
That's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, but so it took me a while to work out that writing what you know can also be included in fantasy and science fiction. It's just you kind of wrap it in magic and cloak it a little bit more. So, I mean, people are people, whether you write about them in modern day or whether you write about them on a world where geist creatures are trying to kill them.
I'd actually like to pursue that a little bit because I participate in a few writing boards and a lot of people are operating under the misconception, I think, that fantasy people are different somehow from real people. And you know, when presented with that argument, Pip, of oh no, fantasy people have to deal with magic and dragons and undead trying to suck their blood. That's not real. How can you make real people into a fantasy story? How do you address that?
Well, I mean, real people deal with, you know, horrible things like relatives dying of cancer or losing their children. I mean, how are those any different to facing a dragon?
Absolutely.
So, I mean, you just take that and you use those sort of emotions, how they would react in that setting. I mean, people are always in danger. I mean, we like to think, oh gosh, I'm going to get really philosophical now. We like to think that we're happy and safe in our homes in suburbia, but I mean, there are just as many dragons outside as in a fantasy novel. They just certainly look a little different, you know?
Well, and the technology that we have around us, holy smokes, is becoming more and more like magic every day.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and the technicians, they're the magicians now.
Yeah, I think if you take out the humanity take humanity away from people when you write about them, then you make them completely inaccessible to the reader.
Agreed.
Along the same lines, looking into these characters, you're talking about bringing in real life, and do you use real people for the basis of every character that you have, or do you at least have somebody that you think about when you're playing with different characters, regardless of whether they're human?
Most often I have like little attributes that I think about, like little touchstones for different characters. But I don't think I've ever met anyone like Saoirse.
Thank God.
I can be grateful for that. But I probably have met somebody like Merrick or like Puck in Chasing the Bard. All these little bits are in there. I mean, that's where the art and the craft comes from, is taking those bits and weaving them into something else.
But is that a discovery that you make after the fact, or is that something that's in your mind while you're writing?
I think it's usually in my mind while I'm writing.
Consciously, subconsciously?
Yes, pretty consciously, actually.
Okay.
When I'm writing someone like Saoirse, then I just, you know, take things to the extreme, and it's all pretty much just out of my imagination. But then other characters, I do consciously have a person in mind or a characteristic of a person that I know in there.
Do you find that that your protagonists or your main characters, even your villains, are modeling behaviors from you?
Well, they do say that every character has a little bit of, I mean, it's got to have a little bit of you in there.
Right.
I think the characters that most contain most of me are the ones I enjoy writing the most, and they're also the ones that kind of get away on me. Like, when I was writing Puck, for example, in Chasing the Bard, he just came fully formed easily, and he started running away with the book, kind of, which was a little scary because I was writing him so easily. I was like, okay, so Puck's in this book, okay, and I kind of wrote him, and then he was like, it almost felt really scary because it was like, no, actually, I'm really in this book. You're not just going to write me as a side character. I'm going to get my own stuff in here. And it was just so easy that I ended up, you know, just going with it. And that makes me sound a little demented. But
no, it's to the betterment of the story. I mean, honestly, I hear writers that talk about, you know, if the audience wants to hear more about this story, I will, by all means, write another story. And I'm thinking, but what do you want to do? If this is the story you want to tell, then tell that story.
And you should have fun while you're doing it.
Absolutely.
That's right. There has to be a little bit of narcissism in it, or it's no fun.
Well, yeah, and that's the whole idea. I mean, the story is a lens that the author crafts and maintains. Mm-hmm. So if you're not invested in that 100%, and if that means that Puck suddenly starts taking center stage, I say roll with that.
Yeah, just go with it. Take the... And it was fun. That was another thing that told me it was okay, was that I was writing Puck and I was enjoying writing it, and his dialogue was kind of, you know, snapping away. He was the first character that was like that for me, and then every character that's been like that since has been a villain.
Something to that.
Very interesting.
Villains are just such, they are fun to write. When T and I wrote Sofia Del Morte, who's the Italian assassin in the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences, it's just like, I just love writing her, and I'm like, I'm writing the next Sofia scene.
Arm wrestling T for the privilege.
Yes, that's right. It's pinochle.
Okay. Yeah. I have a whole new vision of the home life with T. Morris. Awesome. Well,
there you go. That's the writing process, you know.
There you go. Pinochle. There you go. Writers, take that with you. Pinochle. I have one last question. I've been dying to ask this since we started this podcast, and I really haven't had the chance. And this is just a your personal view of things. Mm-hmm. Writing, is it a matter of talent or skill? And by that, I mean, if you don't have the talent, you will never be a good writer. Or is it a skill that can be acquired and that can be overcome? And does talent exist? Discuss.
I think talent does exist. That's my personal opinion. But I think it has to be buffed and shined and made to gleam by pure craftsmanship and working hard at it. But then I don't think you need that much talent if you're going to work hard at it. I mean, the number of people that I've met that said, oh, yes, I'd love to write a book, but they never do. And that's, to me, says that they don't have the talent for it, because if you have the talent for it, you feel like you must pursue it. And, that's my take. I mean, anyone can be a good technical writer with, you know, the right training.
Sure. Well, and the other possible answer for the reason that the person who said they wanted to write doesn't is that they really didn't want to. They wanted something else.
Yeah, they like the concept of the written word.
Sure,
the
sure. And there's a great deal of romance when a reader reads a book and they go into this other world. I mean, for however long that book exists in their awareness, they're transported. I mean, that really is magic. Writers are mighty in that respect. And I think on some level, rightly so, are worthy of some of that adoration that that we as readers give to them. I mean, Pip, let me ask you, the last book that you read that you were just totally floored by, did you not feel a kind of almost reverence for the person that created that story?
Yeah. I mean, for me, one of my favorite writers of all time, because he made me cry, is David Gemmell, who's a British, he's passed away now, unfortunately, but he wrote, I guess you'd call it heroic fantasy, you know, the one man against the masses kind of thing.
Okay.
And I remember, it was called The Knights of Dark Renown, which at the end I was crying at, and I was like, oh my gosh, if I could make someone cry like that, that and somebody actually, when people told me that Chasing the Bard made them cry, I was like, yes!
Yes! Oh, the rush of power.
Cry a mere river.
Pip Valentine, maniacal overlord. Here we go.
That's right.
Weep for me. Well, Pip, do you have any final words for the writers who tune into the podcast to guide or point out different road marks along the way to help them further their craft?
Let me see. Learn to love editing, because in the giddy rush of getting words out onto the page, you can often forget about editing, and that's where the real gems are made. And I cried again. I'm a weepy person. I cried when I got my first professional edit, and then I grew to love the whip.
Oh, <God.
laughs> and enjoy every moment of it. And once you embrace editing, writing becomes a lot easier, because you're like, you know what, if it's not perfect, I'll get it in edits, you know. And that seems to help, especially me with the flow of things. I'm like, you know what, I'm not going to obsess over this. I will sort this out in editing.
Good advice. Excellent advice. Pip, we're out of time. We need to sit down and have a 60 minutes with at some point. But
yes.
But for
this,
now,
this whole 20 minutes with thing just isn't enough.
It never is.
And that's not what it ends up being anyway. So
that's right. We usually milk it for 30 or so.
So it's 20-ish minutes.
Exactly. Yes. We should rename it totally. 20-ish minutes. 20 minutes ish with Philippa Ballantyne. Pip, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing so generously of your thoughts and insights. We appreciate it.
It was lovely to be here and talk, how crying and pathetic I am.
And your ultimate power.
I'll be crying and crushing people mostly.
That's right. Weep for me, Argentina. Yes. Awesome. Brian, anything else before we wrap this up?
No, other than that my favorite new quote is learn to love the whip.
that'll be our new motto on our t-shirts. The Roundtable That's Podcast, right. Learn to love the whip. Thank you, Pip. You've totally altered our brand. We appreciate that.
That's right.
All right, folks. Thank you so much for joining us, as always. Tune in on Tuesday, where we'll have Pip back, and we'll actually do a little story workshopping and trying to dig for some literary gold. Until then, keep writing. What is it, Brian?
Go right.
Go right. Don't go left. Go right. Yes.
That's right.
All right. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com. Or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast. Or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.